The next KNX program will be a special political program.
Great moments in music, usually presented at this time by the makers of Celanese fabrics over most of these stations, will not be heard tonight due to the special political broadcast which follows immediately. At this time, under the sponsorship of the Republican National Committee, we present a political broadcast by Governor Thomas E. Dewey of New York, Republican nominee for the office of President of the United States. First, we turn the program over to his special announcer, Ford Bond.
12 days before Election Day, and all over the country, the signs are now unmistakable. The resurgence of the Republican Party in 1944 is coming to full force in this final drive to November 7th. Tonight, Governor Dewey will speak out on honesty in government from the great city of Chicago in the heart of the United States. There in the huge Chicago Stadium, the governor of Illinois, Dwight H. Green, is introducing Governor Dewey. So here is Governor Dwight H. Green.
My fellow Americans, it is my distinct privilege and honor at this time to present to you the next President of the United States, Thomas E. Dewey. It's good to come again to Chicago and to be the guest of your great governor, Dwight Green. It's also good to hear from everyone that he, together with your next senator, Richard Lyon, will be overwhelmingly elected on November 7th. Since I was here last June, a great campaign has gained force daily to restore honesty and competence in our national government. all over the country, that movement has taken hold. Until now, it has become an irresistible tide, sweeping onward toward victory for a free America in November. The strength of that movement does not lie in any individual. It springs from an urgent conviction in the minds of our people. The women of our country have had a vital part in advancing this cause. Today, throughout the nation, there has been a splendid demonstration of women's contribution to public affairs and of their faith in America. And tonight, Republican women in cities, towns, and farm areas all over the country are meeting to perfect their plans to get out the largest possible vote. Governor Bricker and I appreciate deeply the great work women are doing in this campaign. They've again shown an active and public-spirited citizenship. They will, I hope, take an increasing part in our national leadership in the years to come. The women of America have an especial interest in this campaign because they know that the decisions they make will determine the kind of a country their husbands, brothers, sons, and sweethearts will return to when the war is over. They know, too, that the decision we make next November 7th will determine whether America is to have the kind of government which can carry through to success the hopes of all of us for world cooperation to prevent future wars. And women are also deeply concerned in this campaign because the fundamental issues of this campaign are moral, the simple questions of honesty and good faith. As this world war moves toward our inevitable victory, it becomes our high duty to decide in an election whether we shall save in America the principles for which we have fought abroad. We have fought at greater cost than ever before in our history for high moral principles, for freedom, for justice, and for integrity. Without these, America would become an empty husk. With these, America is the land of opportunity, of faith, and of freedom. Governments, like people, are judged on the principles by which they live. Thomas Jefferson defined the basic principle of government this way. He said, "The whole art of government consists in the art of being honest." That was a good definition when Jefferson pronounced it, and I am old-fashioned enough to believe that it's still a good definition today. Now, let us see how the New Deal's most vigorous supporters define the art of government as it has developed these past 12 years. Here is the opening sentence of a fourth-term campaign pamphlet of which 2 million copies have been distributed on behalf of Franklin D. Roosevelt. It reads, "Politics is the science of how who gets what, when, and why." There, in brief, is the practical lesson of 12 years under the New Deal. There is the practical reason why we find working together for a fourth term, the bosses of the corrupt big city machines, Sidney Hillman's Political Action Committee, and Earl Browder and his Communist Party. They're working together to perpetuate my opponent in office for 16 years because they think they know the answer to the question of who gets what, when, and why. What it is they expect to get, the American people are not supposed to ask or no. When and why they expect to get it is very clear. They expect to get it in the next 4 years as a reward for their services in behalf of the fourth term and at the expense of the American people. But the American people will have a different answer. From the American people, this whole greedy, power-hungry assortment will get a resounding no next November 7th. The New Deal began by casting aside the platform it had adopted in this very city 12 years ago. That was the platform that was called a solemn covenant with the people, and which Mr. Roosevelt promised to support 100%. You know what happened to that. The New Deal went on from there to exploit for its own political ends the plight of millions of American men and women for whom in peacetime it never succeeded in providing jobs. Men and women on WPA and on relief in state after state were shaken down for political contributions to the New Deal for the sordid purpose of buying votes with money which belonged to the needy. People were added wholesale to the WPA payroll before election, only to be brutally thrown off after the votes had safely been counted. Take, for example, the following instructions given to a director of WPA by a Democratic county chairman in South Dakota. They read, "Please place this man on WPA on the special setup you have that takes care of rush men, as welfare will not certify. Have looked into the affair, has 9 votes in family." The whole story was set forth by a Senate committee, 4 of whose 5 members were Democrats. Funds appropriated by the Congress for the relief of those in need, this Senate committee said, have been diverted to political ends. The facts, it said, should arouse the conscience of the country. But my opponent's conscience was not aroused. Instead, he made a speech in Kentucky, where some of the worst of these scandals had been uncovered, and he said, "Personally, I am not greatly disturbed by these stories. Instead of government consisting in the art of being honest, my opponent gave us government as the science of who gets what, when, and why." The tragedy was that the needy suffered so votes could be garnered at election time. We don't want to go back to that after the war, and that's why it's time for a change. Time and again, this administration has sought to do by subterfuge what it did not dare to do directly. You remember Mr. Roosevelt's attempt to pack the Supreme Court. He had a Congress overwhelmingly composed of his own supporters, but that was not enough. He wanted an obedient Supreme Court, one which would follow his advice to Congress, and I quote, "not to permit doubts as to constitutionality, however reasonable, to stand in the way of his designs." He knew no such proposal would succeed if presented in a straightforward manner. So he disguised it in a lengthy plan to reform the courts. He solemnly sent in a message to the Congress of the United States. He said the Supreme Court was behind in its work. But the Chief Justice of the United States nailed that one personally. He announced that the Supreme Court is fully abreast of its work, and he cited the figures to prove it. The Senate Judiciary Committee, a majority of whose members were Democrats, denounced this plan as a proposal that violates every sacred tradition of American democracy. And the Congress rejected it. But time and mortality and 12 years in office have enabled Mr. Roosevelt to pack the courts with New Deal appointees today. The very preservation of our liberty demands that this practice be stopped, and that's another reason why it's time for a change. Now, my opponent, whose veracity had to be corrected by the Chief Justice of the United States, is now talking in this campaign about fraud and falsification. He implies that others have adopted his devious methods. Well, once again, he has asked for it, and here it is. Obedient Supreme Court, one which would follow his advice to Congress, and I quote, not to permit doubts as to constitutionality, however reasonable, to stand in the way of his designs. He knew no such proposal would succeed if presented in a straightforward manner. So he disguised it in a lengthy plan to reform the courts. He solemnly sent in a message to the Congress of the United States. He said the Supreme Court was behind in its work. But the Chief Justice of the United States nailed that one personally. He announced that the Supreme Court is fully abreast of its work, and he cited the figures to prove it. The Senate Judiciary Committee, a majority of whose members were Democrats, denounced this plan as a proposal that violates every sacred tradition of American democracy. And the Congress rejected it. But time and mortality and 12 years in office have enabled Mr. Roosevelt to pack the courts with New Deal appointees today. The very preservation of our liberty demands that this practice be stopped, and that's another reason why it's time for a change. Now, my opponent, whose veracity had to be corrected by the Chief Justice of the United States, is now talking in this campaign about fraud and falsification. He implies that others have adopted his devious methods. Well, once again, he has asked for it, and here it is. A few months ago, Mr. Roosevelt drew up a list of New Deal achievements for the benefit of the newspapers. Almost the first achievement for which he took credit was the Federal Deposit Insurance Corporation for insuring bank deposits. This is a matter that goes right to the heart of the honesty of this national administration. The truth is that the man who sponsored federal insurance of bank deposits was Senator Arthur Vandenberg of Michigan, a Republican, and Mr. Roosevelt opposed it and fought it against it every step of the way. Here's the record, and it's the whole record. Senator Vandenberg first introduced a bill for deposit insurance in December 1932. Mr. Roosevelt had previously opposed the whole idea, and I quote his words, an impossible drain on the federal treasury. Oh. Senator Vandenberg again proposed the bill as an amendment to the Banking Act of 1933. Now let's see what Mr. Roosevelt did then. On June 2, 1933, he wrote to Senator Carter Glass as follows, and I quote it, "I must therefore again express to you my definite feeling that the Vandenberg Amendment must be rejected in toto, even as revised. And I again repeat, no modification of this amendment proposed so far will avoid a serious situation." But Congress passed the bill in spite of Mr. Roosevelt, and now he claims credit for it. I'm glad to say that other members of this administration have acknowledged the truth. For example, the chairman of the Federal Deposit Insurance Corporation wrote to Senator Vandenberg in 1934, and he said, "I consider you to be the father of the Federal Deposit Insurance Act." Once again, we find that social progress is not the property of any one party or of any one man. Certainly, it is not the property of the tired and worn-out New Deal. Yet my opponent, who claims credit for what another man did, uses the words falsification and false witness. This is the same man who, when he ran for a second term, said, "My great ambition on January 20, 1941, is to turn over this desk and chair in the White House to my successor." This is the same man who, when he ran for a third term, said, and I quote him again, "When that term is over, there will be another president." And to make that doubly impressive, he said to his neighbors on the evening before he cast his ballot in that election that this, and again I quote, "is the last time, very obviously, that I will do this as a candidate for office." So now he's running for a fourth term. Is it any wonder that when the White House speaks, the first question the people ask is not whether the news is good or bad, but is it true? Is it any wonder that the Christian Century, an outstanding religious publication read by thousands of God-fearing men and women in this country, has passed this sober judgment on the present administration? And I read it. From the very beginning, Mr. Roosevelt has used deception as a major political stratagem. Until today, he has lost the moral confidence of the nation. Even in the ranks of those blocks which represent his followers, his support rests not upon their confidence in his integrity, but upon the cynical assurance that he will serve their interests because, it concludes, their votes are necessary to his maintenance in power. End of quotation. But deception is not the only political stratagem that this administration has employed in its effort to perpetuate itself in power for 16 straight years. Listen to this brazen piece of business. I have here a letter written October 16, 1944, a week ago last Monday. It's written on the letterhead of the National Democratic Campaign Headquarters, Little Rock, Arkansas, and signed by H.L. McAllister and Sam J. Watkins, State Finance Directors. It begins, "This is an invitation to you to join the 1,000 Club." The idea of such a club, the letter continues, originated at a recent conference
at the White House between the President, Robert E. Hannigan, Chairman of the Democratic National Committee, and Edwin W. Pauley, Treasurer of the Committee. At this meeting, the letter continues, the President commented, quote, I think it would be a good idea to have a list of 1,000 persons banded together from all over the United States to act as a liaison to see that facts relating to the public interest are protected, are presented factually to the President and members of Congress. That's the end of the President's statement. Then the letter continues. It explains the idea behind this plan of my opponent. This is what it says, and I quote, members of this organization undoubtedly will be granted special privilege and prestige by party leaders. These members will be called into conference from time to time to discuss matters of national importance and to assist in the formulation of administration policies. Those are the words of the letter. It continues. To be eligible for membership in the 1,000 Club will require a contribution of $1,000 to the National Democratic Campaign Fund. There, in crude, unblushing words, is the ultimate expression of New Deal politics by the theory of who gets what, when, and why. For $1,000 laid on the line to finance the fourth term drive, this administration bluntly offers for sale special privilege, including the special privilege of assisting in the formulation of administration policies. And the sponsor of this idea is frankly stated in that letter to be the President of the United States. The man who holds the highest office within the gift of the American people, at a conference in the White House, sponsors an idea to sell special privilege and a voice in the formulation of administration policies for $1,000 on the barrelhead. And that's another reason why it's time for a change. Let me make one thing clear right now. In the new administration that takes office next January 20th, there will be no special privilege for sale to anyone at any price. There will be no special privilege for individuals, for groups, or for any section of our people. When that new administration takes office, every American will once again stand equal in the eyes of the government of the United States. We will once again restore honesty and integrity to the White House so that its spoken word can be trusted. In the years that lie ahead, the United States must give leadership to the world if we are to realize the aspiration of people everywhere for an enduring peace. How can we give that leadership when our own government has lost the moral confidence of the nation? How can such an administration give strong and effective representation to the interests of the American people anywhere? How can we hope to solve the massive social and economic problems that will confront us in the post-war years with an administration which has forgotten that the whole art of government consists in the art of being honest?
let us resolve here and now to put an end to government by the cynical theory of who gets what, when, and why. We need a house cleaning of the followers of that practice who for 12 years have infested our nation's capital. We need then to create a responsible cabinet composed of the ablest men and women in this country. We need once more to make government responsive to the will of the people. We need men in Washington who believe in the people of America and in the unlimited future of this country. We need the kind of government in which there will be no place for deception or for special privilege. We need a government that believes and practices in public and in private the art of being honest. With such a government, quarreling and bickering will come to an end, and victory on every front will be speeded. With faith in our future, we can and will bring home 10 million heroes promptly after victory, home to an America with jobs and opportunity for all.
We return you now to New York.
You have just heard a political broadcast under the sponsorship of the Republican National Committee by Governor Thomas E. Dewey of New York, Republican nominee for the office of President of the United States. Governor Dewey was introduced by Dwight H. Green, Governor of the state of Illinois. Great Moments in Music, presented by the makers of Celanese fabrics over most of these stations, was not broadcast tonight due to the special political broadcast which you have just heard. This is CBS, the Columbia Broadcasting System.
KNX, Columbia Square, Los Angeles.